Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And when I say Freedom Fighters, it goes back to when I was living in Argentina and I saw everyone admire Che Guevara as the Freedom Fighter. But meanwhile, it's the entrepreneurs who were building software that really gave inspiration to people in Argentina at the time. They were going to free them from what was going on with local government that wouldn't allow them to work or do all or bring in money from outside countries. And these entrepreneurs just kept coming up with ideas for how to bring Argentines into the rest of the world. I said, these entrepreneurs who I'm interviewing, these are the real freedom fighters. That's who should be admired. And one of the things that I did when I moved to the US and came here to San Francisco was invest in a fund started by one of my past interviewees. It's called the Hustle Fund. Look, I'm even wearing a watch right now that they sent me. It's founded by Eric Bahn. I'm not an investor. The only reason I did is because I love Eric Bahn. And you know what? The thing about Eric is, he's got such freaking great people around him. If he never returned my money, it's still the best investment I made because he does these get-togethers with his LPs, people like me. And they're just, I don't know what it is about Eric. He just draws fantastic people around him. And one of the people who I met at one of his events is the guy you're about to meet in today's interview. His name is Mark Goldenson. Eric Bahn is the guy who introduced us. Mark Goldenson. And as we were talking, I got to know what he did before. Among other things, he started this online therapy business, which years ago I would have said, who wants to do that? That seems a little impersonal. But over the years, I realized that therapy is stinks. Every therapist that I'd been to in person was either crappy or good, but I don't have the time to see them because they're so good that I can't get on their calendar and I'm busy. I can't drive out to go see them. And I've tried online therapy, and man, it's a good format. I've had bad experiences with bad companies, but I recognize that this is the format, the way where you can actually get matched up with the right therapist, where you can communicate with them in a way that's more natural and without all the hassles of having to drive out and park and do all those other things. So I was especially interested in Mark's business. And then he told me about how he built it. He told me about the challenges trying to get therapy online and try and get people to understand it, like me, and how he sold it. And I said, dude, Mark, I love you. Can we please do an interview on Mixergy? And he seemed a little hesitant, and I pushed a little bit because we're friends of Eric's. I think he said yes. Maybe there were other reasons. And so here he is. Mark Goldenson is the founder of Breakthrough.com. He built it into the largest online therapy service. He got it acquired by MD Live. Today, he's got something called Venture Kit, where he wants to publish free startup guides that help founders get things done. And he's a guy who's had a few exits and a few experiences that give him the credibility to actually put this together. The first guide is on how to create a pitch deck slide by slide, and it has 60 examples. I invited him here to talk about his business, how he built it, how he sold it, and thanks to two sponsors. The first is the company that's renting me my office space. I wish I could turn my camera around and show you this whole beautiful environment, but I'll tell you more about them later. It's called Regis, and the second is a company that will help you do email marketing right, meaning treat people right via email, close more sales, and do it with an intelligence that you didn't know was possible. It's called Active Campaign. I'll tell you more about those later. First, Mark, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mark, what did you sell the business for? How much was it acquired for?
Fortunately, I can't say, but it was a nice win for our investors. We raised $6 million overall from social capital, first round capital.
Fair to say you more than 3x their money?
We'll see, because MD Live is not yet public, but they may be going public in the next few years. Telemedicine has been growing, and they and Teladoc are the number one and number two players.
It's weird that it's called telemedicine. Tele is like the remote. It's not about telephone necessarily, right? We're talking about the ability to like take a picture of a rash that I have and have a doctor give me feedback and maybe even tell me, maybe prescribe medicine. Am I right?
Right. Tele means more remote in this case, but we were focused on live video help because the insurers, they feel more, they feel like video is the closest replication of in-person therapy. And that's the one that they're most likely to reimburse. And that was our key distinction, that we were getting the insurers to reimburse.
Yeah, that's about, I had no idea you guys existed and that insurers would actually reimburse that, because they don't reimburse the therapists that I'd go see live in person.
Right.
So that was impressive. The other thing that was impressive is the number of customers that you had. How many did you have?
So we had signed 35 insurance companies that covered over 10 million people. And most online therapy companies that had come before us had understandably not signed the insurance companies because they can be challenging to sign, challenging to work with. But what we saw when I first started the company is that 88% of mental health spending goes through a public or private insurer. So only 12% is out of pocket. And if you want to build a large company, a meaningful company, reaches a lot of people, my belief was you had to sign the insurance companies. So we took on the big challenge of signing them. And it took 2.5 years to sign our first one. It was Blue Shield of California. We needed to make the company work on only $1 million in funding. But once we did, we had 2 million people covered through Blue Shield. And Blue Shield was also bringing their therapists and their some of their marketing muscle to highlighting Breakthrough. And then we were able to sign Aetna and Magellan and some Medicaid agencies and to grow it from there.
And you had 1,000 therapists, all 50 states. How many monthly users?
Honestly, you know, I don't remember.
I have a number here, 30,000 monthly users. Fair?
That at least would sound in terms of visitors, that sounds right, but it's been a few years, so I would want to mislead you, but okay. But it was the largest online service.
I appreciate that. And what's this deal that you had with Walgreens?
So Walgreens was started highlighting our service. They get, I think, something 1 million or 2 visitors a day, and they wanted to get more into telemedicine. They have, you may have seen kiosks where people can come in and get their blood pressure. So they're a nice portal for people to learn about online therapy. And to be able to get that care from wherever they are, including home or work.
Meanwhile, you mentioned First Round was an investor in Breakthrough. They were also an investor in your previous company, weren't they, in Play Cafe?
Yes. Yes, they were.
And what happened to Play Cafe financially? We'll talk about what it was in a moment, but what happened to it financially?
So Play Cafe, we raised $1 million from First Round and some angel investors. It was a online game show network. The insight was I love games and I love game shows. And it's a highly profitable type of programming.
Why? You know what? First of all, why do you like it? I know my dad watches Wheel of Fortune every chance he gets, and Jeopardy. And my wife loves Jeopardy. If it's on anywhere, she'll jump on it.
Yeah.
I don't understand the appeal. What is it for you that appealed to you as a viewer?
I love puzzles. I love challenging my mind, and I find it's inherently fun for me, but I also find like it makes my mind more flexible. So crossword puzzles and acrostics, board games. And so on TV, you get to enjoy this challenge. So whether it was Wheel of Fortune or Jeopardy, some of them are for an older audience, some of them are for a younger audience. But my frustration was you can't actually win prizes. You can't actually be a player in the game, right? You're watching someone on TV. And with the, excuse me, getting over a cold. With the advent of the internet and live streaming, now we saw the potential to make everyone a player, similar to video games on the Xbox, but let anybody win prizes or call the studio or submit questions, talk with the host, talk with each other. So that was the vision of Play Cafe. And we, with this $1 million, we put out shows for about 2 to 4 hours a day. If anybody's familiar with HQ Trivia, it's a fast-growing app on
mobile. It's taking the world by storm. I had to stop it because they'll ping you a few times a day when they go live, right. And it's live trivia questions. The guy is a game show host talking on video to you. He asks you a question. You pick from multiple choice answers, and you're all competing against everyone else there, and there's a real prize. I think it's like $1,000 in cash or nothing huge, and it's divided by all the people who win, and it's just been doing phenomenally. That's what you did.
It's very, very similar. We were doing it in 2007, about a month after the first iPhone came out. So broadband.
Was it web or mobile at the time?
It was only web. We wanted to go to mobile, but the challenge was the internet access was not great at supporting video at the time. Like YouTube, I think, was only maybe a year or two old at that point.
So it was roughly around the time that Mark Cuban was saying that live video would never work online. And he was the guy from broadcast.com who was saying that. So,
yeah.
And this is where you went in saying, I think I could do it.
Right. And Play Cafe failed, and we'll get to that. But I think if we had maybe just done an audio version or scaled back our video ambition some, it's possible that we could have built something like HQ Trivia 10 years ago. I actually reached out to the founders of HQ Trivia and said, I love what you're doing. I think they're actually executing better than we did. It makes sense for it to be on mobile. Our shows are something like 2 hours. Theirs is only 15 minutes. We focused more, a bit more on the dialogue between the hosts. We had live hosts that were interacting with it, were charismatic and great to watch. But HQ is more focused on the questions and the prizes and giving people a small window with which they can play with other people. So I think their execution has been better, but it's funny to see the vision. And I had told friends and some of our investors, I thought, it seemed like a good idea. Why is it that we didn't work? And it's interesting that before HQ Trivia, it's hard to think of any show that was distributed through the web or modal that was live and that was popular, that the internet was still mainly used as a distribution channel for content that was on TV. Like you're watching the Super Bowl or the Olympics.
Oh, you're saying anything that's live was not really doing that well online. HQ is the first real breakout hit of live online TV.
I think so. I mean, what else can we think of that was started on the internet and that has a measure of interactivity? There really isn't anything that I can think of. And I thought that was weird. For Play Cafe, about 40% of our visitors were not even playing the game. They were just watching the hosts. And so I thought one thesis was maybe we were overestimating how many people actually wanted an interactive game. Because I like interactivity. I don't like to just watch sports. I like to play sports. But maybe people wanted more of a lean back experience.
And the reason, by the way, that you're saying that this is the cheapest or the most economical, I forget the phrase that you used, type of content to create, is because all it takes is a host who's dressed up and some prizes, and often the prizes on television anyway are donated by someone. All right. I get it. I get what you were doing with this. It didn't work out. You gave back a significant amount of money, whatever was left. I'm wondering then, when you went back to first round, were they open to it? Did they say, okay, welcome back into the fold, Mark? Yes, we're happy to do it. Or was it awkward?
No, I mean, I think to their credit, we gave back $300,000 of the $1 million we raised to investors. And some of them actually wanted us to keep going. But after 18 months, we just didn't see an avenue to scale the number of users to venture returns. And we were one of the most popular shows at the time on like Justin TV, on live stream. But
how would people compete and respond on Justin TV and live stream and all those other live video platforms?
Well, so we actually worked with Justin. They were happy to embed an interactive player on the Justin TV website. So we're thankful that time. And this is back when they were doing mainly live streaming and had not yet pivoted to Twitch. And I remember thinking at the time when they pivoted to Twitch, I thought, who's actually going to watch people play video games? People play video games for interactivity. And it turns out the answer is tens of millions of people a day will watch. And they were eventually acquired for $1 billion. So kudos to them for having that insight. And I actually have since enjoyed watching some Twitch streams, to my own surprise, because even though you're not playing the game, you're watching a charismatic host, you're watching interactivity, you're learning about how to play a game better. There might be music playing in the background. There are several things that are going on there that I didn't realize until I actually tried the experience. So I think, you know, first round was supportive. And when we returned money back and then I started my next venture, they then invested in Breakthrough. And I think they're some of the best stage investors.
Sorry to interrupt that. There's so much that I want to cover with you. And I think I just got over eager there, which will probably happen a lot in this interview. I know you talked to our producer and we asked you before the interview where the idea came from. I still am not clear about it. What you've said is that you and your co-founder have backgrounds in medicine, therapy, psychology. But a lot of people have that kind of background. First of all, I didn't realize that you had that in your background. I don't think I saw it on your LinkedIn profile. But second, just having the background in it doesn't make you realize this could work online and here's how we could do it. Where did you come up with the idea?
Right. So my background is I came out in 97 to the Bay Area to go to Stanford. And the reason was I wanted to study lucid dreaming while knowing you're dreaming. So conscious dreaming. It's where you have full physical experience of what's going on in your dream. Anybody who's had lucid dreams can attest to this, that you can eat things and taste them. You can fly through clouds. You can have dream sex and feel everything, but there are no physical or social constraints. And this isn't something theoretical and unproven, like, say, astral projection. We know from our lab research, from thousands of people across the world who have attested that this is an actual experience. I've had it myself. And I learned about it in high school from a book that I got called Exploring the World of Lucid Dreaming. It's by Dr. Stephen LaBerge. And I thought, people need to know about this. We need to know more about it. We need to know about what is the brain activation associated with lucid dreaming? How can we make it easier to induce? Because it is a learnable skill, but it takes time. You have to typically keep a dream journal, find what patterns are on your dreams, improve your dream recall. So I wanted to come out to Stanford to study with Dr. LaBerge to study the neuroscience of lucid dreaming, because that's where he was. So I came in and worked for 4 years on the psychophysiology, the neuroscience of lucid dreaming, particularly using EEG and fMRI brain imaging to understand that. So what I came to the conclusion of is it's indeed a fascinating field, but research is lonely and slow and hard. And I believed it was going to take another 5 to 10 years of research minimum to get to what I really wanted to get to, which was this universal lucid dream induction method. So instead, the dot-com boom was happening around Stanford around 2000, 2001. And so I got pulled into a startup. And from there, my career detoured more into entrepreneurship. I realized I really loved building teams and companies. I started the squash team on campus and actually co-founded an online marketplace with Eric Bond's co-founder, Elizabeth Yin. That's how I came to know Elizabeth. She and I started a Craigslist for Stanford called the Stanford Bazaar, with the insight being that a lot of trade on college campuses is hyper-local, and Craigslist is not optimized to that. Stanford eventually acquired the Bazaar, and we thought, can we scale this to 10,000 colleges?
Craigslist acquired it?
No. Stanford acquired it.
Oh, Stanford. Okay.
Right. But we just didn't see a way to solve the two-sided network effect of a marketplace 10,000 times. If we had had the insight of a social network back in 2001, like many people, we would have started Facebook, but we didn't have that insight. So getting to why breakthrough, I've since stayed aware of mental healthness, mental health and wellness and psychology. After Play Cafe stopped, I thought, where else could live video be applied? Because I gained some expertise in it about how do you maximize bandwidth, minimize jitter, make it a reliable experience. Even though the technology back in 2007 was not stellar, we had Adobe Flash, which is since fortunately being phased out. And therapy seemed like an obvious application. That 1 in 4 Americans have mental illness. Therapy has been shown to be as effective as antidepressants, whereas no real side effects. Excuse me.
Do you want to grab a drink of water?
I'm okay, actually. It's just post-contextual cough. So I was excited about it, and I knew about the main challenges in the mental health system. The four ones that I believed we could work on were the high costs, that it costs about $1,000 per course of treatment, the low access. 90 million people live in areas that are underserved by mental health professionals. The average town that has 25,000 people or less have zero psychiatrists. 75% of them have zero psychiatrists. So if you're
getting all this data though, but to me, I didn't understand watching people playing video games online either. Emmett Shear understood it because he was doing it and he got it. I didn't understand therapy for a long time happening via video either. How did you get that made sense?
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, even back then, I had done video chats just like we're doing now and felt that you can establish a rapport. You can have a fluid conversation.
But you didn't talk to a therapist or anything this way.
Oh, no, I did. I mean, I talked to therapists in person and through live video.
Wait, your therapist used to do live video with them?
No. As part of the market discovery.
Just as part of discovery.
So you spent about 4 months analyzing the market, talking with patients, talking with therapists to get a sense of would both sides adopt this. And I became convinced from those interviews that they would. There were actually fewer skeptics than I anticipated. I think it would have been hard if we were starting in the late 90s or 2000, like a few companies did. And I actually talked with the founders of those companies back then, and a few became advisors, to understand what has changed. And back in the late 90s, 2000, people were hesitant to put a credit card in a form or to date online. And now in 2007, there was more openness. And there was more openness from the insurers. We started in 2009 to do that. So that
you talked to insurers also. You would have conversations with them and say, are you open to this? And then they said, yes, if what?
So it solves a few problems for them. One is they actually want to increase access to good providers. So one insurer is a major one, United Health, has over 100,000 therapists in their network. And I said, well, you must be glad to have a therapist network so large. And they said, well, actually, we would actually prefer to reduce it in size a bit, because one of the reasons it's so large is they have these proximity requirements where a therapist, they have to have a therapist within a certain range of where a patient is. And if, like, say, I don't know what it is, 25, 50 miles. And if they don't have that, then they're out of compliance and they can be sued by the state regulator. They can get fees.
Oh, I see.
So they have to take on therapists that are not as experienced and they know, frankly, are not as good as some other therapists to meet those proximity requirements. So we eventually, with United Health, went to the state regulator in California and said, if United Health were to offer Breakthrough, would it satisfy these proximity requirements? So someone could be a patient in all the way top of Northern California and talking to a therapist in the bottom of Southern California. Would that meet the requirement? And the regulator came back and said, yes, it would. So now what that allows United Health to do is actually shrink their network a bit, increase the average therapist quality, and they like that. It also, if you can get to patients when their symptoms are mild to moderate, then you can address the issue faster potentially and reduce the catastrophic cost, the hospitalizations, the long-term medications that really cost the insurer and cost the patient as well.
Okay.
You can also do better matching because there's evidence that the number one driver of outcomes in therapy is what's called the therapeutic alliance. And this basically is how much the patient trusts the therapist and vice versa. And the analogy I use, it's a little crude, but it's like dating, where you need someone who really gets you. And if you have a much wider pool of therapists to choose from, ideally all over the country, all over the world, you're more likely to find that match to open up to get someone who uses the technique and the communication.
Yeah.
And
frankly, how do people find therapists right now? They go to ask their friends. Well, I've got really close friends who watch Star Wars. I'm not a Star Wars buff. I haven't seen many of those movies. They're not bad people, but we have different tastes. Same thing with therapists. And that's just a bad way to find a therapist. All right, I get that. Let me take a moment to talk about my sponsor, and then I'm going to come back and I want to ask you a follow-up question, something you said that just it's a simple question, but it's really important. And the sponsor is a company called Regis. Do you know Regis?
I do, actually. I think I used our office once.
I've been renting from Regis ever since I went to Argentina. I decided my wife and I live together. I can't work out of the house and have her there. I need my own space. I love her, but you know, it's kind of awkward when she's hanging out and I'm not hanging out with her because I want to sit at the office. So I got office space from Regis, and one of the things that I noticed was I started focusing more on work, and I started getting more in the work mindset once I was there. And it's not just any old office. It's because Regis is just meant for frickin' business. A lot of these co-working spaces are meant for hanging out and making you feel comfortable. I don't want to feel comfortable. I want to feel like everything around me is ready for me to get work done, including make sure my coffee's ready, make sure there's a receptionist ready if someone wants to drop something off. I don't have a lot of visitors, but I do have someone dropping things off from time to time. And that's what Regis does. They are all over the world. What's the most exotic country that you've gone to? Let's see if we can find a Regis over there.
New Zealand.
Okay, that's much farther, but I bet they're going to have a Regis in New Zealand. Let's see. Regis. Every time I go somewhere, there you go, regis.co.nz. They've got plenty of space in New Zealand. And the reason that that's important to me is because when I go to foreign countries, sometimes what I want to do is sit and just work for a little bit, and the coffee shops have bad internet, or I'm not sure if there's theft, or I need to be in a quiet space to work. I know I'm with Regis. They're going to give me a desk. I'm going to sit there. I'm going to have internet. And frankly, almost always the same username and password for Wi-Fi. So I just open my computer. It's like being at home and I get work done. I was in Argentina. I had a question about where I should take my wife on a date since I was living there and I wasn't sure. I went to a receptionist. I said, hey, where should I take my wife? Great. She recommends a place. My wife loved it. I had to send something out by mail. I know I should be an adult and be able to send out something by mail. I hate it. What I do now is I just take the thing to the receptionist and I say, can you please send this? Here's the address that it goes to. And they send it for me. This is great. I get to focus on business, the work that's important to me. And unlike other, like, first of all, they're the biggest, as far as I know, the biggest co-working company out there, which means they're everywhere. Any place I go, they have it. They're really super professional. I have my own quiet space, you know, my own office, four walls and a door. It's great. But they unlike others, they're not about hanging out. They're about getting stuff done. If anyone out there wants space from Regis, frankly, you could just go to regis.com/mixergy. They'll take you for a walk around this one of their spaces. They'll show you what they have. And if it's not a good fit, it's not a good fit. If it is, you could sign up. But a little beyond that, what I would suggest is, since I've had such a personal relationship with them for so long, I'd be happy to introduce you to the person who I work with over there. Just email me, andrew@mixergy.com. I've been with them for years. Argentina, Buenos Aires, Argentina, DC, San Francisco. And then from there, everywhere I've gone when I needed office space, they've had it. All right. The only place I had a guest who was on, he grew up in Moldova. They don't have office space in Moldova. So if you're in Moldova, Regis is not there yet, but who knows? They might be building space there too. All right, let's move on. The question I had was, how do you get together with regulators? You're just a guy with an idea. How are regulators in California talking to you when I can't get the person who's taking my taxes to answer a question from the state? Right.
So this was part of the analysis also of not just were the insurers ready for online therapy, but were the state and federal regulators. So I talked with one or two beforehand, and they were cautiously warm to it. So these include the medical boards like the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association. And the psychiatrists in particular were open to it.
Forgive me, but the thing I'm wondering is, how do you even get to them? Are you just looking them up and you get to the right person and they're open to you because you're interested in being in the space?
Yeah, regulators typically want startups to reach out to them. They want to have an active conversation. They don't want to have to crack down on startups that they haven't heard of. And I think that's true outside of healthcare too. It really was a question, right? Because do you really want to bring the regulator awareness of what you're doing if it's going to be, in the gray area? But in this case, healthcare, it's so sensitive and therapy is so sensitive. We wanted to make sure we were compliant. So one of the key questions, for example, was around cross-state practice. So would a regulator or an insurer be okay with a therapist in California talking with a patient in New York? And it turns out that we have a 50-state patchwork of regulations around this. Some states were okay with it, some were not. And we wanted to be a mainstream, above-the-board service that therapists would not worry about whether or not their license was going to get stripped away. So we made the tough decision early on to take that issue off the table and only let therapists talk to patients in the states where the therapist was licensed. And that let us be compliant everywhere. So if you're a therapist in California, sure, you can talk to a patient in New York, but you have to get licensed in New York. And then we had a service that would help those therapists get licensed in all 50 states if they wanted, take away 90% of the paperwork. Most didn't go that route, but it was there for them. So basically the practice was deemed to be wherever the patient was. And that did mean that this vision of being able to talk with anyone in the world had to wait until the regulators caught up with this. So we were going to stay US focused for now. But it still meant that if you were in a rural town, or you met someone that was in a different part of your state or a different part of the country and was licensed in your state, you still could meet them. And that was still a real win for patients.
You guys built the app in 11 weeks. Was it you internally who built it, or did you get an agency to build it for you?
No, so we worked with a great development firm called Collective Idea, Daniel Morrison and his team. They had actually built an online therapy service before, and that was one of the reasons we went with them. And they helped us build before we launched at TechCrunch Disrupt. It was called TechCrunch 50 at the time. But we were racing to get the site ready to demo. We actually didn't even finalize our name. The domain name we got done closed, I think about 3 to 5 days before the conference. And so we didn't even know what we were going to call the company. We had signed a contract to acquire Breakthrough.com. But we didn't yet get the ownership of the domain. And so it was one of those things, and you can imagine like where Indiana Jones is like sliding under the door that's closing. And we got in and got the domain just before the launch. The TechCrunch people were not happy.
You gotta tell people how much you paid for that domain.
What would you guess?
I know the number.
Okay.
Do you want me to now you say it?
So it was for $50,000 and some token equity. I was a small business owner, Terry, who was great and a fan of psychology. He had the domain since what he calls the dawn of the internet. Uh-huh. And he had a company called Breakthrough Systems. But he didn't really need a domain that was that prominent. And he was interested in the funds for a different project. So we started a conversation, and over 3 to 4 months, he liked what we were doing. He initially wanted $100,000 for the domain. We said, you know, Terry, that's something not what we can do, but we can do in the vicinity of $50,000, and we can do some equity so that if we win, you win. And eventually we came to an agreement. We were really happy with it. It was a domain that I think fit our brand and signaled to all of our stakeholders that we were a serious company.
What could it do when you announced it at TechCrunch 50? This is back when Jason Calacanis was the MC and co-leader, creator of it. What was it that that the app could do?
Not that much. So it was had a therapist profile. It was HIPAA compliant. So sorry about the
call. How is it HIPAA compliant?
So HIPAA is a set of rules on how to protect patient data.
Uh-huh.
And so there are you just simply follow those rules, though they are kind of vague, so that can be frustrating for startups. But there are some best practices that we followed and that companies can still follow to be considered compliant. But it's not a one moment in time. HIPAA is more of a process you have to follow in order to be compliant. So, but we had messaging, we had phone calls, we had video. When I say not much, like we still had not done a lot of other features that we wanted to do, like and eventually did, like assessments. Video introductions were popular. So we were talking earlier about matching. Eventually, we filmed video introductions for about a third of the network. So that would let people who were interested in getting therapy get a sense of what the therapist is like. What's their communication style? Are they more of a tough love or more of a sensitive therapist? Male, female, young, old?
How did you get all those therapists to be a part of this thing?
Well, so first we would just cold call. So our first 50 to 100 therapists, we were looking up those that had an online presence. We went to therapists and were in our network or friends of friends. And then once we started getting insurers, the insurers were excited to share their therapist networks with us because it made their providers, particularly their high quality experienced ones, more available. Until eventually we had the largest network, to my knowledge, of online therapists.
Okay. You had them all in there. I see the TechCrunch post about you guys when you guys were launching. One of the things that they said that was exciting about the company was Obamacare was going to make healthcare available to more people, and as a result, more people could potentially sign up. Did that help?
Yes.
It did come through.
It did. Part of the plan was the Mental Health Parity Act that treated mental health care on par with physical health care. So before then, sometimes insurers would charge you more for a therapy visit than for a primary care visit, and that would deter people from getting therapy. So Obamacare and the Mental Health Parity Act limited that. It just made insurance more available, and so people were more able to use their insurance to get online care through Breakthrough.
Okay, so you're saying HIPAA compliance was part of it. The ability to chat, meaning text chat with my therapist, that was part of the first version?
So no, we only focused on video. Okay. There are services now that will let you text chat. I think it's okay. I think video is by a significant margin the best medium for therapy. It's just much higher throughput. You get a greater sense of each other. No, we could have built it, but it's also something the insurers were not thrilled to reimburse.
Okay. Live video was part of it right from the start. So I would see a video menu of people. I could pick the one I want. I could schedule with them using the app. And then once I scheduled, I have a private in the app video connection to that person. Even you guys at breakthrough.com could not listen in. It was just me and my therapist talking. Got it. You launched it. How did you guys do a TechCrunch Disrupt? You didn't win.
Right. I think we were voted the best of our session. But no, we didn't win overall. And that was fine. Like we got great press from it. We were able to raise our first seed round in part based on that. But I would say back then, healthcare companies were seen with some skepticism from investors. There are a lot of healthcare IT companies that have not done well. It's a hard space to penetrate. And so it took us about 2.5 years to raise our eventual $5 million Series A. We had to show more insurers, more traction to get there.
You raised $900,000 soon after that, though, wasn't Keith, I don't see it in my screen, but Keith Raboy from mm-hmm. PayPal, the investor now, mm-hmm. he was part of it. I guess he was COO of Square at the time. You've had mm-hmm. Other people from PayPal. I guess that's because of your background there. mm-hmm. Charles River Ventures. I guess they prefer to go by CRV now. They're the ones, mm-hmm. they were also in there. So you had a really good group of people who were investing. Mm-hmm. Did you get any customers from being on stage there?
I don't remember any insurers coming at that point. The main driver of our insurer contracts was not me, but my co-founder, Julian Cohen.
I guess when I say customers, I mean clients of the therapists.
Oh, yeah. I think we got a few, but honestly, the adoption early on was small. This is one of those, it was similar, I think, to the story of, say, Airbnb, where there's a trickle of adoption until you get your awareness out, you build trust. I'll admit it was discouraging at times when the traction was
low. Why did
you
continue? You were into live game shows. That didn't get huge traction, and you said it's time to give back the money. Why don't you say the same thing here? You know what? I'm too early again. I'm an innovator. I'll wait. I can't get into this now. Why'd you decide I'm going to tough this out? And it was a tough slog, as we'll discover in a moment.
Yeah. I mean, I admit that thought did go through my mind at times, but I believed the product made sense. The market made sense. And I was familiar with, I love marketplace business models. And I knew that it's a flywheel. You have to push it for a long time sometimes. And particularly once we could get an insurer, I believed that their access to patients and therapists would be a huge jump in our traffic. And eventually that was true.
What is the flywheel? The flywheel is, describe what that flywheel looks like in this situation, the one that you banked your life on at that point.
Right. Well, so, I mean, a physical flywheel, if people don't know, it's a large wheel, and you push it sometimes to like generate electricity or some kind of kinetic energy. And it takes a lot of time. Like, if you imagine a big bicycle wheel, it takes a lot of time to get those first rotations. But once you get momentum, you can keep the flywheel going a lot. So in our case, we actually had a three-sided marketplace between patients, therapists, and insurers. So this creates a strong network effect also, where as you get more patients, you get more therapists. As you get more therapists, you get more patients. And if you get insurers,
let me pause you right there. Why do more therapists bring in more patients? It's not like they're advertising on their websites, come sign up for me on breakthrough.com, is it?
They are actually. So
they were. So they were specifically promoting that the way to connect with them was, I see, got it, okay. Yeah.
For a few reasons. So therapists will sometimes have patients who move and they want to keep that relationship. So they'll say, well, you're moving to California, I'm still in New York. We can stay in touch.
Why wouldn't they just say, pay me online and use Skype to connect with me? You and I are using Skype.
So the insurers would not reimburse typically for Skype. They were only reimbursing for sessions done through Breakthrough, because Breakthrough was more specifically HIPAA compliant. We had assessments that would collect patient data to give insights into provider quality. So before every session on Breakthrough, after about year two, my co-founder Julian had the idea of, let's present a custom assessment to measure how the patient is doing in that moment. And then we can track how the patients are doing.
Oh, I see.
And that's powerful, because in mental health care, this has been something that's been talked about for a while. It's called outcome-informed care. But we were really one of the first to actually do it. Because it can be, especially in person, a pain to have the paper, track the paper, transcribe it, present it in a graph to patients. And some therapists just don't do it. Aetna actually tried to pay therapists $10 extra per session to collect this data.
Okay.
But Aetna was going to use it in part to rate their providers, and the providers were resisting that. But we came and said, no, we want to collect this data. It will help patients know if they're getting better. It will help insurers know which patients are getting better or worse, which providers are good at certain techniques. This data should exist. And so we told the therapists, we're going to do this. We'll do it on your behalf, but you need to be okay with that. Otherwise, you can't be part of the network. And so that, I think, was a powerful way for therapists to feel like we're adding value and for the patients to stay on the platform. But yes, technically, people could have gone off the site. I'm sure some did. But for the most part, we saw sessions staying on site.
Wow. I had no idea, partially because you told our producer that you guys used to joke that you guys were the antiviral company. And yeah. I get the health slant on that, but I thought that there was no viral connection because people didn't want to talk about the app that they used for therapy because they didn't want to talk about therapy. Okay. So the more clients you have, obviously I could see therapists being attracted to it because they want more work. Now I see more therapists on the network means more clients because they're telling their potential customers, can't come see me in person, don't want to start to figure out what my schedule is, just go to breakthrough.com and sign up for me. And then you said the insurance companies also help with this flywheel, which created more momentum for more customers, more clients, right. I should say, in your world. How did the insurance companies help bring in more people?
So they would put in their provider directories that some therapists were active on Breakthrough, they would send marketing to some of their patients via mail or via email. So there was some co-marketing. They were slow at first. Large companies like Aetna, Blue Shield, they are they have a lot of priorities, and helping a startup is or working with a startup is not always a top priority. But once they started to put out that marketing, we did see a lift in our numbers.
I'm wondering why. I thought that health insurance would be happy to take their clients' money and not ever have to pay any of it out to mental health practitioners, doctors, or anyone, because that's money out of their pocket. They would think, great, sure, sign up. Don't ever use this. The harder we make it for you to use it, the better it is for us. Why would they want to promote the fact that people could use their insurance more?
There are a few reasons. One is, we touched on earlier, preventative care. So they, if a patient gets severe depression, anxiety, PTSD, ADHD, then the patient care becomes more expensive. The risk of hospitalization is higher, and that's more money that the insurer has to pay out. Whereas if a condition can be caught when it's mild to moderate, costs a lot less. Some of it is just regulation that they are mandated, particularly under Obamacare, to deliver certain services. And part of it, I think, is genuine. Like, the insurers are not always a bad guy. They do want to deliver high quality care. They make their higher quality providers more available to reduce costs. But sure, not every insurer has that, that insight. There also was this separate, entity, accountable care organizations. So this is where a provider group is paid a lump sum of money up front, and then the insurer is incentivized to keep people healthy at a certain benchmark. So there are certain benchmarks they'll measure, and to do it cost efficiently. So they want to minimize the amount of money they spend, but they still want to keep their patient population healthy. And it turns out that online care is a way to reduce costs. You can have therapists that are in lower cost of living areas that are still good, meeting patients that are from dense urban areas. Or you don't have to pay therapists to travel, like if they're going to elderly senior homes. Usually those therapists need to be paid for travel time. Here you don't.
You know what? This is still up and running. I should try. I haven't been to therapy in a while. I guess I don't even need it, but I should still try it in case I want it in the future.
I think everybody needs therapy.
You do?
I think need is too strong a word, but I think everybody can benefit from therapy. You don't necessarily have to have a condition. The way I think of it is, here's an expert in personal change. Someone who you can sit down with for an hour, who will listen to whatever you want to talk about, and it can be sensitive, it can be not, and they'll try and help you through something. So I guess the question would be, is there anything that you want to improve on personally? And I think we all do, even if whether we recognize it or not. And a good therapist can help you with that.
I like, too, that it's covered by insurance, because otherwise it costs, sure, a lot of money to go see a therapist. But right, frankly, the biggest issue for me is, the one I liked was in Noe Valley. Noe Valley, there's no freaking parking. I have to, right, rush over to Noe Valley from here, go find parking. It takes forever. And then the guy's in such demand. At the end of each session, we talk about, when can I see you again? And then we finally scheduled it, and he moved somewhere because he wanted to make a lifestyle change. What the hell?
Yeah.
All right, let me talk about my second sponsor by asking you about VentureKit. I'm on VentureKit. You've created this really incredible post, how to create a pitch deck. On the right side of the post, though, is subscribe, get new posts by email. I think you could be doing a lot better there. Is this inappropriate for me to bring up to you? An ad for Active Campaign?
Go for it.
I think, here's what I think you should do instead there. What I think you should do on the right is say, I'm creating more of these kits. Enter your email address to get the next kit. Or enter your email address. Maybe you want to write that down a little bit more pithy way. And then on the very bottom underneath this post that is, dude, you put a lot of work into this. You're not a half-assed type of person. On the very bottom of it, what I see is comments. And there aren't that many comments on the bottom of it. I would get rid of the frickin' comments, or if you keep it in there, right above the comments, I would say, my next kit is coming up. Hit this to get it, or enter your email address to get my next kit, and then add them to a mailing list. Now, I'm a little partial. It's okay for you to say what email software you're using. What email software do you even know?
MailChimp.
MailChimp. Great. I figured it was going to be MailChimp. Why are you using MailChimp?
It was an analysis I did a while ago. I like the price and used the product before and seemed to like it, but I'm open to alternatives, honestly.
Okay, I'm gonna try to convince you to use someone else. I don't think MailChimp is bad. I think that for our use in our world, it's not the best decision, and here's why. What you want to do is, you want eventually, as you have more of these kits, to see what are people clicking on? Is there a topic that they're especially interested in? And then if they are, you want to start to target the future messages based on that. What you also are going to want to do is eventually you're going to have people joining your mailing list, and you're going to want not to send them the next kit that you create, but maybe you have the sequence of kits that you send out. The first kit that I think every entrepreneur needs to get is, and you send that out a day after someone signs up or a moment after they sign up. The day after that, what you might want to do is say, hey, you may not even know who I am. Maybe you just stumbled on this website. You should get to know who I am. I did this interview with Andrew at Mixergy where you can go and get a little bit of my background. Or I did this Reddit AMA and you link them to that and you keep track of that. And if you see someone's clicked on five of these things about who you are, in that case, or five things that are especially useful, you tag them a certain way and then maybe they're the ones who you offer to do a 5-minute consultation with because they're highly engaged and they're the kinds of people who are more likely to want to work with you. I don't exactly know what those criteria are, but what I want you to pick up from this is ActiveCampaign, really inexpensive, feature rich for doing things like dripping content based on when people signed up so they don't all get the same thing and what they've done both on your website and in email. And this is really phenomenal. If somebody actually has clicked on something and then they get a follow-up email that has something to do with what they clicked on, they feel like it's a more personal connection. They're more likely to stay subscribed. Let's take a look at what ActiveCampaign costs. ActiveCampaign, usually I've been talking about how they have a free trial. Let me see. Where is the... You know what? I've gotten into trouble with this in the past. I accidentally misread the price and then I get into trouble with the sponsor and they want me to edit and I don't edit. Let me see if I can make it work. All right, here. It looks like they have a light version that starts at $9 a month. So we're talking about pretty inexpensive tool that even allows you to have three users. And the reason three users are important is you might want an assistant or an intern or someone on your team to help manage it. And you've got that with them. All right. Anyone who's curious about ActiveCampaign should go to a special URL I'm about to give you because not only are you going to get a free trial of ActiveCampaign so you can see whether it's for you or not. You could always dump it if you're not happy with it, but most people will end up being happy with it and keep it. But you'll get a free trial. You're also going to get your second month for free, and you're going to get two free one-on-one sessions with experts who will show you how marketing automation, how really customizing the messages you send to people based on what they've done on your site, what they bought from you, what they've done in emails you've sent them in the past, how long they've been a subscriber, etc., how easy that is. Those two consultation sessions will set it up for you. And if you are like Mark and many others and you're with MailChimp or other email providers, they're really good for the majority of people. But once you get into smart marketing, you need help and you need better software like ActiveCampaign. If you're with those software and you want to switch using this URL, they will migrate you for free. It's for a limited time because frankly, we I think are sold out for all ads for the rest of the year. So write this down, save it for when you're ready. ActiveCampaign.com/Mixergy. ActiveCampaign.com/Mixergy. All right, let's continue with your... How's it feel for you for me to do ads in the middle of an interview? Some of my audience are thinking it's a little awkward. Some people think it's great because the guest gets to jump in. What do you think? Be open with me. We're friends.
I think it's fine. I understand that content creators need to turn in revenue. I think the interactivity is good. I think it just comes down to the quality of the product. If you believe in it and if it's a product that the audience is actually interested in, I think this works fine.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I don't know if I got a chance to say to you, but I almost always say before, if you hate the sponsor, I won't run it. And number two, if you dislike them, bring it up in an interview. And I've had that because I think that helps hold me accountable that I see you. I can't talk about BS with you there. I'm going to feel like an idiot, right? And if you have a negative experience, you can jump in. And all those things help to keep these ads as honest as I possibly can make them. All right. So now you have got this model up and running, and it's time for you to get insurance companies. My wife has been on the insurance company for months to like repay something. It's not easy even as a customer. How do you, as an outsider, what was your process for convincing all these insurance companies to sign up with you?
Right. I mean, this is where my co-founder Julian really worked his abilities. His entire 30-year career was as a mental health executive. He was the CEO of Aetna Behavioral, their mental health division, the CMO of United Health, one of the largest insurers. So the opportunity and the challenge is that market is highly relationship driven. And I didn't really have relationships there. I'm networked in the tech community, and product and tech is what I'm good at. So I needed to team up with someone, Julian, who could get these executives in a room and with his experience convince them that this newfangled internet thing was worth investing in. And he was exceptional at that. It did still take a long time, but we would never have been able, I think, to sign the insurers if it was just me. So what are the tactics? It's a lot of just good listening and selling, right? So understanding what was going to motivate different insurers. And as we've talked about, it tends to be lower costs, greater appropriate access, regulatory compliance. There are certain features like the data collection that they were interested in to understand better which providers were good at treating which conditions. And frankly, we were the only game in town that had the level of technology that we had and was willing to work with the insurers. You could, even back then, Google online therapy and find a half dozen different fly-by-night players that were trying to charge direct out of pocket. But as you've said, it's expensive. It was about $100 to $200. It still is per hour if you want to talk to a therapist. There were really no good options if you wanted to just pay your copay of $15, $25 or nothing at all. So for the insurers, we were the main player to work with.
You said that the MD Live was a major player and the other major company was Teladoc.
Mm-hmm.
That's who he's with now, huh?
So he was. He I think is either still there or might have rest recently. But yeah, he ran their entire behavioral division.
And behavioral is what?
Mental health.
Mental health. Wow, I see. So all of his background, I'm looking him up on LinkedIn. First, I didn't have his last name, so I looked up Julian and Breakthrough. There's apparently a jazz musician named Julian who's really popular with Google who just, and he's got a song named Breakthrough and just kept coming up. But now I see it. I'm looking at his LinkedIn profile. I see that he has a lot of experience being on boards, being in these companies. Okay, and it took a couple of years. And at some point in there, you guys had to give people pay cuts. Why did you guys get to a point, or when did you get into a point where you had to give your team pay cuts?
Yeah. So we were going for about 2.5 years on just $1 million in seed capital. And it sounds like a lot of money, but when you have a team of roughly 10, it's not a lot. And so I've been earning sub-market salaries for a long time. And we were getting to the point where we had the traction we thought to raise a Series A, but it was going to take a bit longer to go through the conversations. So I went to my team and said, I think we can raise a Series A. We all know our numbers, but it's going to take somewhere around 3 to 6 months. And so I said, the only way we can do this, one of two ways. I can either let some people go and keep the current market salaries, but then that's going to slow down our growth. Or we all agreed to take a cut. And I forget what it was. It was significant, somewhere 25 to 50%. But we make an IOU and we put it in a contract that says, if we raise money, we will pay you everything that we've cut. And, you know, it was heartening. Everybody signed on. Nobody left. And some of our people had families, but I think an advantage of doing something like what Breakthrough is doing is you get people who are passionate about the cause. It's not just another ad tech company or virtual game or whatever. People really believed in it. And so they took the pay cut. We closed the funding. We backpaid everything that we had not paid out, and it worked out great.
Wow. And how long did it take you to pay them back on the IOU?
I don't remember. I think it was a few months. It wasn't like a year.
Did you do any other kind of marketing that helped out? So you told me about starting out getting therapists, and then therapists helped bring in clients. What else did you do that brought in more clients?
We tried a few things, and some things just didn't work. Like we tried social media, didn't really work. We tried SEM, search engine marketing, didn't really work. SEO worked a little, but not much. A lot of people are not searching for online therapy, so we just needed to grow awareness. The methods that tended to work were the insurers, and also we had some early evidence that primary care providers would work. So the number one driver of mental health visits is primary care providers. 70% of all antidepressants are prescribed by PCPs. And that's
really?
Because they don't really, they aren't as familiar with antidepressants or psychotropic medications compared to mental health specialists. So the insight here is go to PCPs and say, look, 1 in 4 patients that come through your door have a mental illness. You're not going to do therapy with them. You'd probably rather not prescribe medication for them because you're not as familiar. It increases your liability. You'd want a specialist. So the majority of visits tend to come from a PCP. How many therapists is a PCP going to know? And what tends to happen is that these PCPs have 1 or 2, maybe 3 therapists, psychiatrists that they refer everyone to. But we know, like, the for the roughly 2,000 patients that a PCP is going to see, if a quarter, 500 come, it's unlikely that one or two therapists are going to be the best fit for all 500 patients. So our pitch to the PCPs is, here's an entire directory of 1,000 therapists all over the country who accept all different insurance companies, all different techniques, genders, ages, experience, techniques, styles. Give your patient access to Breakthrough. Just all you have to do is send them to breakthrough.com and we'll take it from there. And now we'll also keep you in the loop. So when a therapist sees one of your patients, those notes will be shared via HIPAA compliance to you, so you can, we can have coordinated care. And it doesn't cost the PCP anything.
And so what was your campaign for reaching out to all those different primary care physicians, PCPs?
Right. So there are certain aggregations of them, like there are conferences, groups that they tend to subscribe to. However, getting to PCPs is hard. They're the gatekeepers of the healthcare system, so they are constantly pitched by specialists, by startups. So we really had to try and build those relationships, and we had early evidence that was working. But by the time that we really wanted to scale that out, the acquisition had already happened. But I would say that it's a piece of advice for healthcare startups. And I think a lot of them know this, that if you really want to drive referrals in a cost-effective way, find a way that you can make it make sense for the PCPs, because they are the gatekeeper.
You know what? I'm trying to check out the app and get app feedback on it as we're talking. And I feel like the app has not been updated as much. Is it still, is breakthrough.com still up and running?
I honestly haven't checked it out for a long time. It's been 3 years. MD Live has been running it, so I don't know.
Okay. Why did you sell? It seemed like things were finally clicking. You were getting all these insurance companies, getting providers, getting clients.
Yeah. So so two reasons. One is we were getting offers, and it had been 5.5 years. I honestly, personally, was burned out at that time. And the second is we wanted to raise a next round. We had $8 million committed, but we wanted to raise a round of like 10 to 12. And we were challenged to try and find a lead investor. So this is one of those frustrating things where you can have your existing investors and other investors want to come on, but a lead investor doesn't necessarily want to come on, to set the terms and to get on the board. So a combination of those factors, we thought it made sense at that point to have the company acquired. And again, we did have multiple offers to choose from, and I think eventually our investors will do okay on it. But my preference really would have been to be an independent company to grow even larger. And just, you know, I think there are things that I could have done better, like invest more in marketing, and hire more people early on. I was taking on a lot of jobs. Effectively, I was the VP of product, VP of marketing, and the CEO for a while. I tend to like to get into the details, and that's something I think I would do differently next time if I start another company, is really try and delegate and be a true CEO that's managing the doers instead of trying to do so much myself.
How'd you hook up with MD Live?
I don't remember if we reached out to them. I think we all, the space was small enough, I think we all knew about each other. So I don't remember exactly how it went, but we talked with several of the companies in that space, and they eventually made the best offer, so we went with them.
All right, and you ended up with equity in MD Live, and that's not cash. And the way you're going to know how well it does is when they go public or when you exit.
Right,
you're basically now an investor, an angel investor there.
Correct. Yes.
You've had two other exits, right? Am I right about that?
Mm-hmm.
Stanford Bazaar, we talked about, you sold to Stanford. What was the other one?
So this was Whoosh. We were building
Whoosh exclamation point.
Yes. Yeah. It's very, very .com. We were building small business storefronts that were back-end integrated. So what that means is, back then and still today, if you have a small business, you have a system for tracking inventory, for issuing invoices, for managing your contacts. And back then, a lot of that was done offline, or if it was done online, it was done on a computer sitting somewhere. And a lot of the companies like Yahoo stores that were coming along were not integrating with those systems. So if you're a small business owner, you have like three employees, you may not have an IT worker, and you get an order that comes in. If it comes to the website, you want it to go into whatever system you have to track your orders and issue invoices, but a lot of those systems were not integrating with their existing system. So we wanted to come in and say, we want to integrate with your existing system, so there's not an offline and an online system or two online systems. There's just one system you use to run your company. So it was a good idea. I think still think it is. But we raised $20 million. And we made every possible mistake you could possibly make. It was a complete disaster. I was the COO. I had no idea what I was doing. We had too many founders. We just didn't execute well. So after a year, I saw it was not going to have the outcome I wanted. And I went back to school. I had dropped out of Stanford twice. The first time.
I saw that on your LinkedIn profile.
Yeah, the second time for PayPal. But it was a good experience. I still think it's actually a good idea for today.
PayPal back in 2002, 2004. So this is the kind of question that if I saw your Reddit Live, your Reddit AMA, I would have jumped in and asked you, but I'll do it here where it's a little more awkward, but still important. Where's your money coming from then? It looks like MD Live is that you didn't cash out. Play Cafe, you return the money. Whoosh, you made a lot of mistakes. Where's the money coming from that you're investing as a limited partner in Hustle Fund?
Yeah. Oh, so I'm actually not in Hustle Fund, but I am angel investing. So, I mean, it's just a combination of PayPal and salaries over the years. But I would acknowledge I am not filthy rich, but I am happy to moving into investing and might be joining a firm. And this
but as
year,
an investor, don't you have to have like to be an accredited investor? You have to have a certain amount of money and a certain salary. You're not making a salary, so it's a certain amount of money.
Right.
Yeah. And that's from PayPal?
From a variety of things.
That you're not, like a lot of people, I feel like no one's checking to see if we're accredited. A lot of people just say, all right, sure, let's just invest, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, and I'm not going to be making a ton of investments as an angel investor. I would want to be, you know, either I'm going to be raising a fund or working with a larger VC. It's just, you know, I've been around that long enough that I've been able to, been fortunate to acquire capital to do this. It's true that I'm not liquid on the MD livestock, so I imagine I'll be able to make a few more investments.
So how'd you end up at the Hustle Fund cocktail party as a non-investor? I mean, I could have just hung out as a friend of Eric's.
Yeah. So Elizabeth is a friend. You know, as I mentioned, she and I were co-founders long ago. And I worked with Elizabeth at 500 Startups, where she was a partner and I was an EIR. So I was able to do some investments and advising out of that as well.
So I'm not an LP in any of these funds. Is this the way they usually are, that you get to hang out with other investors? You get to know the founders of the fund? Is this what it's like? Because this is way better than going to a country club.
It is pretty exciting, honestly, on the investor end. I've been a founder for so long to constantly, I mean, it's similar to what you do, right? You get to meet founders, tend to be passionate and sharp, doing interesting things. And every now and then you get to help them make their dream be a reality. I'm really enjoying the investing side so far.
That's some really smart entrepreneurs there.
Yes. Yeah, I wish I could say yes more often. But you know, it's not just networking. I feel like the good investors do have to do rigorous analysis of markets, and there's a lot of gray area. There's a lot of fuzziness into which company is going to do well. And you know, I look at the companies that really, no pun intended, broke through in the last 10 years, and I would have missed deals like, say, Twitch. I might have missed Airbnb. Maybe I thought differently if I had seen the numbers, but Snapchat I probably would have missed. A lot of these companies, it can be hard to figure out what's really going to get traction. So that's the challenge. But I would say that the lifestyle, you know, it's different than a founder. There are lower highs and higher lows, but it's still a lot of work. And so far, I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, it does seem like it. I kind of like their philosophy over at Hustle Fund, where they want data. But I missed the value of what they were saying, because frankly, I didn't know that you could get such great data. And I think that Eric was not a person who's like really good on selling stuff. He's just very casual, at least he is with me. It wasn't until I talked to some of their entrepreneurs and I said, who cares? They're getting all this data. What's the thing? He goes, are you out of your mind? Do you know how much data they now get and how much analysis they could do on behalf of the entrepreneur and how they could? I had no idea. They're just, and then I talked to the intern who's using Zapier to take in data from things like GitHub to understand how fast these companies iterating. It's just, this guy's a freaking brilliant, but Eric is too freaking quiet to tell me anything like that. He's just like a, I don't know. I feel like he's a bit of a savant. Like I'll tell you where I understood Eric's brilliance. I invited him and other people who I interviewed to scotch at my house. He says, you know, I can help actually tell people a little bit about it, or somehow it came out. So I say, you know what? Sure. Anyone can say anything at my house for scotch. Come on over. He brings these specialty glasses that I still have to this day because you smell scotch better with the glasses. He gave me a list beforehand of scotches that I should have because he wanted to make sure that we kept it, like that we had high quality. And then he printed out information about each scotch, and he didn't just do a scotch tasting. He told people what was in it, and he answered. And then I thought maybe this guy did some research and, you know, this is his way of relating to people. No, we we had all these smart people. They had all these questions for him. And the guy pulled out the answers. He understood it. It was freaking brilliant. I'm obviously very much in love with Eric.
He's a sharp dude, and he has more of a soft self, right? I like him a lot.
Yeah, I tried to live wherever he lives. Where is it? San Carlo? I took my wife into the air. I said, look, we should go where Eric lives. She looked around. She said, there's not even a Starbucks in here. What's going on? This is the suburbs of suburbs. We couldn't do it, but that's how much I believe in him. I think if he's doing something, I want to be a part of it. All right. I wonder, is that illegal for me to say that why I decided to work with him? Does this feel like I'm pumping his fund or anything?
I don't think so.
All right. If I'm in chains, I'm going to use this as a reference. All right, Mark, in all seriousness, I really enjoyed hanging out with you that night. I enjoyed talking with you. I admire the amount of work that you put into the content that you put out there. The website, for anyone who wants to check it out, is venturekit.com. I hope that everyone gets to have a chance to talk with you. And frankly, your email address, I'm going to give it out. It's mark@venturekit.com. If anyone wants to talk to an entrepreneur here in the Valley with a lot of experience and a lot of great connections, and who's also, frankly, just a good guy to talk to, go check it out. Go email him. And the two sponsors that I mentioned are The Office Space, where I am, 201 Mission Street. It's a Regis office. They take good care of me here, and they'll take great care of you. Go check them out at regis.com/Mixergy, or contact me, andrew@Mixergy.com. I'll introduce you to someone. And whatever city you're in, there's a Regis probably, and they will give you a tour, and you could decide whether you like the office or not. And if nothing else, you just get a sense of how you could be working. Even if you don't sign up, they'll give you a sense of what's out there for you or your company. One person operation, multiple people, whatever it is. Andrew@Mixergy.com. I'm talking about them a lot, Mark, because I want them to return as a sponsor, and they're very not like a podcast sponsor type of company. So I want to knock their socks off. All right, and the second company is the company that will help you send email out right. It's called Active Campaign. Check them out, activecampaign.com/Mixergy. All right, that's the end of me promoting stuff. But I'm really proud of these companies, and I'm really proud of my relationship with Mark. So I'm linking you guys up to all those things. Mark, thanks so much for being on here.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being a part of it.